Welcome to the 299th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host, Randy Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are a review of Patrick's weekend predictions, a preview of the Super Bowl, and a look back at the last week in college basketball and the NBA, including some, let's just say, major trades. Let's jump right in, though, starting with a look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, which are posted every Thursday on our social media. Those handles are at 4th and 24. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24. And we'll start in the NBA, where Patrick went 3-1 with his weekend predictions. College basketball, on the flip side, he went 1-3 with his predictions. That means Patrick went 4-4 this week. And that brings his overall record to 1,274 and 792, a 61.7% winning percentage. Patrick, your thoughts on your weekend predictions?
Well, obviously not too happy with the college basketball predictions, but felt I did fine in the NBA. I'll start in the NBA. The Lakers beat the Knicks 128-112. That was the game I got wrong this week. And the other three, the Thunder beat the Kings 144-110. The Pacers beat the Hawks 132-127. And the Grizzlies beat the Bucks 132-119. Again, got all of those right. So a good week in the NBA. Then in college basketball, the only game I got right was that number 8 Tennessee beat number 5 Florida 64-44. And then I unsuccessfully picked three home teams. Number 22 Texas Tech went on the road and beat number 6 Houston 82-81 in overtime in one of the crazier games this season. Number 20 Missouri beat Mississippi State, who's ranked number 14 coming into that game, 88-61, just a complete blowout there. And then New Mexico beat Utah State 82-63, another blowout there in a game that was supposed to be a lot closer, but overall, definitely some wins by those teams that kind of changed their outlook for the season. Not so much necessarily in games that they were really supposed to be super close in. I mean, these were all supposed to be somewhat close games, but you know, mostly picked them because they were ranked versus ranked matchups, with the exception of New Mexico and Utah State, who are both at the top of the Mountain West. But definitely changing the season outlooks on those few teams there with those wins.
All right. Well, Patrick's predictions for next weekend will be posted on our social media, as always, on Thursdays. Let's now turn our attention to the NFL with a preview of the final game of the year, the Eagles-Chiefs Super Bowl.
Yeah, this is exactly the Super Bowl that a lot of people thought it might be heading into the postseason. I, of course, had the Ravens here instead of the Eagles in the Battle of the Birds. But, you know, the Ravens, as we know, dropped that two-point conversion and didn't even get the chance to take on the Chiefs to be in this game. So instead, it's the Eagles and the Chiefs for the second time in the last 3 years. These are teams that are very, very familiar with this stage. Obviously, Andy Reid had been the Eagles head coach for a few Super Bowl appearances, even though they never won it with him. And then, of course, Doug Peterson came in and won that Super Bowl with the Eagles. Now Sirianni in his second appearance after losing the first one. Chiefs are currently favored by 1.5. The over-under's at 48.5. And, you know, this is a really interesting matchup. I mean, I'm on the fence about this one. I think that overall, like I said, I picked the Eagles to be in this position, and I believe I picked the Ravens to beat the Eagles. I said that this would be Lamar's year to break through. But, you know, I really feel like out of these two teams, I've liked what the Eagles have shown more all year long. But at the same time, the Chiefs just don't lose. They have not lost at all. And no matter how close these games get, they just haven't lost them. And you know, that was the same thing a few years ago when these two teams matched up in the Super Bowl. So although I have reason to believe that the Eagles will win, it's really, really hard to actually come out with that prediction as an official one. I am going to say, though, I'll predict that the Eagles actually do win this game, even after all that debating. I do think that, you know, the Chiefs, look, honestly, I just think it's boring to pick the Chiefs over and over again. So I don't want to pick them again, just because that would be the three-peat and, you know, getting tired of looking at this team being there for a while. We all know that I'm not a big fan of any dynasty, but the Chiefs are definitely close to becoming a true dynasty in the NFL and just showing what they're made of once again. But I think the Eagles have what it takes to kind of disrupt that. I don't think the Chiefs have played a running game like the Eagles all season long, other than when they played the Ravens earlier in the season. But I think that Saquon and the Eagles O-line is on another level from all the other teams in the league. And I also like the way that Jalen Hurts has been playing recently. I don't think he's been, you know, he hasn't been, he well, he didn't start the playoffs playing up to expectations. But I think that, you know, against Washington, he made some good throws. AJ Brown got more involved. And overall, I just like what I've been seeing out of the Eagles. I feel like they're playing well enough on both sides of the ball, especially with all their additions on the defensive end. I think they have what it takes to come out and win this game, despite the fact that the Chiefs are the favorite and obviously the two-time defending champions.
Yeah, I think most of America, except maybe 48 states, maybe Missouri and Kansas, maybe not even parts of Kansas, feel like you do want to see somebody else win. The Chiefs would be historic, obviously, if they get a three-peat. People forget how close they have been to losing these Super Bowls. They have won, what is it, three of the last four Super Bowls, I believe, and but that hasn't been easy. Come from behind victories, overtime wins, et cetera, et cetera. I think obviously the key to the game is can Saquon Barkley, can they contain Saquon Barkley on defense? Chiefs do have a good defense because Barkley's big plays have been the difference for the Eagles and makes them not have to rely on what has sometimes been an uneven passing game between A.J. Brown and Jalen Hurts, although it looks like they've gotten it going lately. I too am rooting for the Eagles. I don't not just not being a hater. I just kind of I like you. I don't like dynasties unless it's my team. And my team is not in the NFL. Very interesting matchup. I do know one thing. Everybody's going to be very sad Monday morning when football season is over. So I think we should just sit back, relax, enjoy the game, and hope for a good game. The other thing people forget is it used to be, and you probably don't even, I think I've told you these stories. Super Bowls used to be blowouts. We never used to have good games. And we've been blessed recently with some, really, really competitive games. I don't recall the last blowout. Obviously, we've had some great come from behind victories, not only from the Chiefs, but with Tom Brady against Atlanta. There's just been really, really good games. So I think we are going to get that. And that's really, I think most America wants a good game and obviously wants the Eagles to win. If you don't have any further thoughts, we'll shift gears. Let's change gears and move to basketball action, starting with the most significant college basketball action from last week.
Well, like you said, we are reaching the end of football season, which means it's fully time to talk as much as possible about the world of basketball, especially college basketball. We know my specialty personally. Look, this was a really, really, really interesting week. I mean, I think my weekend predictions were kind of only the tip of the iceberg in terms of results this week. A lot of teams put up some one good performance and one bad performance. It was one of those weeks where you were just lucky to escape with one win if you only played one game, two wins if you played two, and just, you know, move on to the next week and hope that things get better. But starting with number 12 Kentucky, who beat number 8 Tennessee 78 to 73 on the road. Tennessee, I mean, look, the one thing I have to say is that this team really doesn't know itself well on offense. They know that they're a defensive team and that's what they need to build behind. But they think they have five Steph Currys on the floor at all times, and they really have five, like, I don't even know what's a good comparison. They have like five Jared Van, they have like four Jared Vanderbilts and one Seth Curry instead. They do not shoot the three well on a consistent basis, and they won't stop shooting it. It's kind of baffling to me. They shoot 33% as a team from three, but really, most of that, if you look at their roster, they actually only have two players who are shoot. They have one player actually who's shooting above their season average as a team from three, and that's Chaz Lanier, who's shooting 42% from three. That would be the Seth Curry in my reference there. Not going to compare him to Steph though, because obviously that would be an unfair comparison to Steph. But look, Zakai Ziegler is only shooting 28% from three. Jordan Gainey's shooting 32.6, which is fine but not great. Igor Milicic is shooting 28.4. Jemai Mashak shooting 32.3% from three. And it's just when they play games where their defense doesn't dominate, they look really, really bad on the offensive end. And I think we saw that in the Auburn game where I don't remember the exact, they shot 18% from three, barely got one to go in at the end of the game. And this game against Kentucky, they lost because they shot 11 of 45 from three. When the shots aren't falling, there's no point in shooting them. They just don't believe in that philosophy. I don't know why. Kentucky made more threes than Tennessee did in this game, shooting 21 fewer attempts. They went 12 of 24 compared to Tennessee's 11 of 45. And I'm surprised, frankly, they should have lost by more. They should have won by more, honestly. Kentucky should have. But Going -8 in the turnover differential will do that to you. Tennessee bounced back later in the week, and I'll talk about what happened then. But we're gonna keep going, talk about number 11 Kansas, who beat UCF 91-87. Kansas has had a surprising amount of close games this year, especially on their home court. And that game was no different. UCF had a chance, actually had a shot late to win this game. It was actually one of those games where, UCF got their final shot up with like 8 or 7 seconds left and then had to foul Kansas at the end of the game to hold out any hope of a win off a potential missed free throw. But this was really a close game throughout. Kansas, I won't say they didn't deserve to win this game, but not a great performance, although more on them later. Number 13, A&M beat Oklahoma 75-68. This team just continues to stack up wins against tournament-level teams. They're just consistent. I mean, I know that their style of play isn't exactly the greatest to watch. If I say that Tennessee can't shoot threes, A&M is like a D2 team in terms of shooting. I mean, they really, really struggle to shoot threes. But the fact of the matter is, they just keep winning games. They're really, really physical. They attack the boards, and they're really great on defense. And every once in a while, they can turn it on from three. And also, they get so many looks off of their offensive rebounding that even if they don't fall, that threat is still there for the defense because a lot of those looks are wide open. That's a great time to shoot a three, always is right off of that offensive rebound. Then you have Louisville, who beat Wake Forest 72-59. They were winning by more at some point in this game, but Wake did a good job to cut it to be closer at the end of the game, helped their metrics out a little bit. Number 4, Alabama beat number 14, Mississippi State, 88-84. Josh Hubbard had 38 points in this game for Mississippi State. He's been really, really inefficient this season, and kind of, to be honest, the thing that's separating Mississippi State from being a top 10 team instead of just a near top 20 team. And I think this week they might have even fallen out of that range just because of the few losses. Yeah, they're now at 22. But I really do think that Hubbard, if he can get to be a lot more efficient from the field, this is a team that will be really, really dangerous, as we can see in this game, because they went on the road and only lost Alabama by 4 in a game where he went off. And then, later in the week, not so great of a game, and they lost to Missouri by a ton at home. So that kind of shows the dichotomy of that team. But then you have number 6, Houston, who beat West Virginia 63-49 on the road. Houston had a complete and total lack of quad one wins on their resume, despite just, any team that they played that's kind of in that quad two, quad three range, they just demolished, which is why the net and which is why KenPom love this team. But they don't have the quality wins to really back it up until kind of a few weeks ago, obviously starting with that win over Kansas that was really, really helpful. Then this win over West Virginia helps a ton as well, as they continue to shoot up the seed list, even now making it more even with their ranking in the AP poll. Then you have Maryland, who beat Wisconsin 76-68, a really good win for the Terrapins. Speaking of lacking good wins, they came in not this week, but the week before that, with only one quad one win on the season. And now all of a sudden, they have 4 of them with this win over Wisconsin and the 2 wins they picked up last week on the road at Northwestern and at Indiana. But Maryland playing some good basketball. They finally realized just how talented their roster is, and they're starting to play like it. They have a protected lottery pick, or projected, excuse me, lottery pick. I'm now thinking NBA trades already, so I said protected. A projected NBA lottery pick in Derrick Queen, who's a freshman, and then Julian Reese, who's been there for a while, in the front court. And then also Jacoby Gillespie has been really, really great from the transfer portal. And then Rodney Rice and Selton Miguel have been really great, kind of complementary pieces to that big three. Whenever the defense puts too much attention or starts to put too much attention on Reese, Queen, or Gillespie, those two are really just too good to kind of leave on their own. And they've capitalized on that all year long. Both of those two scoring in double figures, I believe. Then you have number 23, Ole Miss, who beat Texas 72-69. A good week for the Rebels with that win, and then what they did later in the week, even though they lost. But good win for them. Texas, meanwhile, they need wins. The SEC is tough. You're going to lose games that are really, really close. All you can hope for is that eventually, when you get on your home court, you defend that, and you get wins there because it's really, really tough to win on the road. And you're going to play a lot of ranked teams, both on the road and at home, obviously. Then you have UCLA, who beat number 16 Oregon 78-52. Oregon, I think, probably entered last week as maybe the most overrated team in the country. I still think they're honestly slightly overrated because I don't know why they're receiving votes as a ranked team. I mean, they have lost a ton of games in a row at this point. And I'll talk about the other game that they lost later this week. But they actually still have more ranked votes, both by the coaches and the people, than UCLA does, despite UCLA beating them by 26 last week. I don't know what else you could need as evidence that they're a better team. UCLA has the season sweep, actually, on Oregon. They beat them in Eugene as well. That was Oregon's first loss of the year, actually, was at home to UCLA. But again, UCLA has gone on the road and beaten Oregon and then also beaten them at home by 26 points, including 4 wins in a row for UCLA, by the way, including over a ranked Wisconsin team. Actually, 5 wins in a row, including over a ranked Wisconsin team and 2 road wins against Washington and USC, who did something pretty notable later in the week that we'll talk about. I have no idea how Oregon is still getting more votes than UCLA. And frankly, UCLA should be pushing for a spot in the rankings, sitting at 16-6. There are 16-6 teams that are ranked, including Mississippi State and Ole Miss, and Kansas at 15-6, and Kentucky at 15-6. So I think, and by the way, Kentucky and Kansas closer to the top 15. So I think UCLA should be ranked considering how much momentum they have and how well they've been playing recently. But we all know APU voters don't seem to pay that much attention to what's actually going on. Then you have Nebraska, who beat number 18 Illinois 80-74 in overtime. I thought there was a chance that Illinois might stay ranked this week, and somehow they did. They have, speaking of teams with a lot of losses, Illinois sitting at 15-7, but they're still ranked, even after losing to a Nebraska team that heading into that game had lost 6 games in a row. Don't ask me how they're ranked. Can't give you a real answer. There are a lot of teams that deserve it, and Illinois is not one of them at the current moment. I do think overall they are a top 25 team in the country. Don't get me wrong. In terms of over the course of the season and who do I trust in March, blah, blah, blah. But the fact of the matter is the AP poll is supposed to be kind of more of a power ranking, and it clearly is not serving that purpose. Then you have number 10, Purdue, who beat Indiana 81-76. This game closer than I thought it would be, closer than it probably should have been, but doesn't matter. Michael Woodson teams in the clutch doesn't exist. They do not execute whatsoever in those moments, and they failed to do it once again against Purdue, and it ultimately led to their downfall once again. Then you have all the games on Saturday, and oh my, was it a busy Saturday. Starting off with number one, Auburn, who beat number 23, Ole Miss, 92-82. Again, I said Ole Miss, their win over Texas was good. I actually think this performance against Auburn was arguably a better performance from the Rebels, just because we know how far above the rest of the teams in the country Auburn is. And, you know, Texas, meanwhile, kind of more of a bubble team. So beating a bubble team by 3 at home, I think honestly might barely be on the same level as losing to Auburn by 10 at home, because they really did keep this game close throughout all the way until the end. So credit to Ole Miss for playing a good week. I think that they're still a team with a lot of potential, even though they've kind of hit a wall recently a little bit in terms of actual win losses. I think this week was a sign of improvement going forward. Then you had the first notable matchup of the weekend in terms of, you know, name brand value. It was number two Duke who took on North Carolina. But I mean, look, this was a matchup in name only. Duke is miles, miles better than North Carolina this season. I mean, this is not Coach K's final year where North Carolina is going to get into the tournament as an 8 seed and maybe spoil Duke's season along the way and sweep them in the season. This team is not anywhere near the level of Duke. It's just not close. Duke won that game 87-70. Cooper Flagg for most of the first half had more points than North Carolina did as a team. I think I just kept checking it, and it was still, you know, 15 points, 4 assists, 3 rebounds, compared to North Carolina having 12 points as a team, and it was 27-12. I mean, it wasn't a game at all. But then again, you never know what will happen in college basketball, and that was proven this weekend when Kansas State went on the road and beat number three Iowa State 80-61. I think there are three things surprising here. First of all, Kansas State beat Iowa State on the road because Hilton Coliseum is almost an impossible place for anybody to win. And second of all, Kansas State is terrible. I mean, this is not a good team at all. So for them to pull off, for them to get any win on the road in the Big 12 is honestly surprising, unless it's against a team like Oklahoma State, maybe TCU. And then to add the cherry on top, they did it by 19 points. Like this was not a, you know, this is not an Iowa State Arizona type situation where Arizona hit a half court shot to send the game to overtime. And then, you know, the Cyclones were just kind of defeated for the rest of the game. This was just not a close game. Iowa State just could not stop Kansas State. We know Kansas State has talent. I mean, They spent, I don't know, probably more than their football team did on NIL this year, but still, they should not be winning games like this. They're not a good team. But then again, maybe they're starting to play up to their potential. Maybe they figured something out chemistry-wise. I have no idea. But it was a very, very shocking result to see. Then you have number four, Alabama. They beat Georgia 90 to 69. Alabama, again, taking care of business. Two wins this week, solidifying their spot on the one line with a bunch of teams sliding everywhere else. I mean, it really feels like there's kind of a, I don't know if you can call Duke and Auburn a 1A and 1B. I really do think Auburn is a lot better than Duke, but you know, I guess you can call them a 1A and 1B because Duke did beat Auburn when they played each other and only has two losses on the season. They probably will run the table in the ACC. But you know, call them a 1A, 1B if you want. But I really feel like Alabama is kind of a very, very, very clear number three at the moment with how they're playing, just because the next team's up, Tennessee, they have a 30-point loss to Florida on their schedule. Florida at number six now has a 20-point loss to Tennessee somewhere on their schedule. And Alabama just hasn't lost in a while. Whereas, you know, even a team like Houston. Houston moved up in the poll this week despite losing at home to Texas Tech. I mean, talk about AP poll oddities again. But Alabama, you know, they have five straight wins. Before that, yeah, they lost to Ole Miss at home. But then before that, I mean, they hadn't lost since the Players Era Festival against Oregon, which is a really close game. But that was all the way back the week of Thanksgiving. So they have lost one game since Thanksgiving. That's a really, really good team that people need to talk about a little bit more as a team kind of behind Auburn and Duke, and then, you know, kind of joining up into that next tier of contenders. And speaking of that Tennessee Florida game, number eight Tennessee beat number five Florida 64-44. Tennessee still can't shoot the ball, but they play good defense. I mean, we know that they're going to do that against Florida on the road. Florida was able to just kind of get into their flow on offense when these two teams played each other. They won 73-43 earlier in the season, back when Tennessee was number one and undefeated. But then in this game, obviously, Tennessee coming off two straight losses, desperately needed to bounce back. No Zakai Ziegler either, but a really, really good defensive game. The ugliest game I think I've ever watched. Like, really, really bad. Florida shot 4 of 27 from three, 13 of 53 from the field. Neither team shot even 75% from the free throw line. The best shooting percentage in terms of relative to averages and what teams normally do was Tennessee going 40% from the field, which isn't good. But you know what? Chaz Lanier, he had 19 points on 5 of 9 from three. The rest of the team might have gone 1 for 13 from three, but that was just enough to lift Tennessee over the edge. And as I said, he really should be the only guy shooting threes on that entire roster. But then I talked about it just a little bit ago. Number 22, Texas Tech beat number six Houston 82-81 in overtime. A really good win for Texas Tech and a really bad look for Big 12 officiating because about only a few minutes into this game, they ejected a Texas Tech player, I believe it was Darian Williams, for a pass where, you know, he kind of turned over his shoulder on a double team and had to jump in the air to throw the pass over the double and accidentally kicked someone. But they gave him a flagrant two and ejected him from the game. Grant McCaslin sees the replay on an iPad of a staffer and then the computer of, I think, the SID. I think he was watching it on TV. And he just went ballistic. And he chucked something into the crowd, and they obviously ejected him for technical. But as he described it, a terrible call. And as he described it, it was the best hug he ever had in the post-game locker room after that game with the player who was ejected. And Texas Tech, really, I mean, this is probably, I don't think people are going to talk about it by the end of the year, but this might arguably be the signature win of the season if no one's going to beat Auburn for the rest of the year. Because this game, to have one of your best, to have your leading scorer ejected in the first, when it was 8-7, and to have your coach out, but then to go on the road and win a game in overtime against a top six team in the country, that is almost impossible to do. Especially when you consider how many fouls they called in the rest of this game, two on both teams. So a lot of foul trouble and having your best player ejected really early on is just really tough to deal with. And yet Texas Tech did it. And it's a really big win for the resume that was kind of lacking in big wins, despite the fact that predictives wise, they're a top 10 team, according to all of those metrics. And now it's been reflected. They jumped from 22 to 13 in the poll, which is mind blowing. But they are at 17-4 in the season, even if their non-con wasn't very strong. You know, they played really, really great basketball in the Big 12. Speaking of upsets, USC beat number seven Michigan State 70-64. I think it was bound to happen that Michigan State was going to lose a game at some point. Would I have told you it would come to USC? Not necessarily, but USC has been playing better recently. I'd guess if you limited the efficiency metrics to kind of the last 3 or 4 weeks, I wouldn't be shocked to see them in at least the top 30, maybe even higher. They've been playing a lot better in recent weeks. So good win for USC. They need to outperform expectations by a lot for the rest of the season to really push for the tournament, but they're not that far out, and the bubble is really weak this year. So it is possible that with the wins they have, they might have a chance, and they've shown the flashes. They almost beat Michigan. They almost beat UCLA. You know, could have converted those games. They didn't, but they did get this win. We'll see if they can turn some of those almost wins into actual wins for the rest of the season. Then you have number 25, UConn, who beat number 9, Marquette, 77 to 69. UConn is ridiculously overrated, and they still are even after this win. But at the same time, this was a good win for them to go on the road and beat Marquette. They will never get a shooting performance like that, especially in the first half, though, for the rest of the season, until Liam McNeely is back. So I would write this off more as a one-off than an actual sign of something they can sustain. Then you have Baylor, who beat number 11 Kansas, 81 to 70, continuing to make Kansas one of the weirdest teams to look at and hardest teams to evaluate in the country. You just never know what you're going to get from them on a day in, day out basis. This was a game where they actually blew they had the largest blown lead in school history to a Baylor team that was only playing 7 men in the rotation, had somebody foul out, and had VJ Edgecombe leave at the end of the game with an injury. So no idea how they lost that game. Then you had Coach Cal's return to Rupp Arena. And what else would happen but for Arkansas to randomly jump up and beat Kentucky in this game, 89 to 79 on the road, after Kentucky had gone earlier in the week and beaten Tennessee on the road? It was instead, of course, like I said, Arkansas getting their second conference win of the entire season by going on the road to Rupp and beating a top 15 team. Makes absolutely no sense, but here we are. A great game. A lot of storylines, obviously, and just really, just honestly, just really a fun game at Rupp Arena. But Arkansas comes out with the victory there. Then you have number 13, A&M, who beat South Carolina 76-72. Again, just stacking up the wins. That game is on the road. Number 20, Missouri, beat number 14, Mississippi State, 88-61. We talked about that in predictions. Number 15, St. John's, beat Providence 68-66. Way closer than it should have been, but a win is a win. They are now 19-3 on the season. So, really good season for St. John's. Are really easily going to make the tournament as long as they don't have any slip ups in some Big East games at the end of the season. Then you have number 17, Wisconsin, who beat Northwestern on the road 75-69 in Northwestern's first game without Brooks Barnheiser, who will now be out for the rest of the season. Kind of changes the Big Ten picture, eliminates maybe a contender of a, not a contender, but a team that, you know, could jump up and pull off an upset here or there. They already beat Illinois earlier in the season and Maryland. Both of those teams, of course, now ranked. But, you know, now without Brooks Barnheiser, just not enough scoring for the Wildcats to really start pulling off those upsets. But speaking of upsets, Georgia Tech beat number 21 Louisville 77 to 70. Maybe one of the more surprising results of the weekend, other than kind of that Kansas State game and the Arkansas game. This one kind of flew under the radar, but Louisville had been playing amazing. And all of a sudden, this loss to a team with a sub 500 record on the season. Then you have Oklahoma, who demolished number 24 Vanderbilt 97 to 67. Commodore's time in the AP poll short-lived, but you know what? They made it there and they deserve some credit. They're still in the tournament for now. They might not be a tournament team, but they're threatening it. Then you have Wake, who beat Pitt 76 to 74. Really close game there. Pitt would go on later in the week to lose to Virginia at home, which is just shocking. But at this point, that team is just completely fading out of the tournament picture. You have BYU and UCF, who are both on the bubble. BYU beat UCF 81-75, though, which would be a really important win for the committee to look at, especially because BYU went on the road to get that win. Meanwhile, UCF, you can't drop home games to other bubble teams if you really want to make the tournament. New Mexico beat Utah State 82-63. Talked about that in predictions. St. Mary's beat Gonzaga 62-58. Some horrible big end of the game execution from Gonzaga. I don't know if they think they're Indiana or something, but just really bad there. And St. Mary's continuing their strong season. They're undefeated in WCC play despite the new additions of Oregon State and Washington State. Then Nebraska beat number 16 Oregon 77 to 71. Again, Oregon continuing their slide. Number 18 Illinois bounced back from their loss earlier in the week to Nebraska by beating Ohio State 87 to 79. And then Memphis beat Rice 86-83. You know, Memphis just needs to make sure that these close games don't turn into losses. This one got dangerously close. But if they're not going to blow everybody out, they do need to keep winning every game. They can afford to pick up a loss or two in the American if they're going to beat teams by big margins, but they're not doing that. So they just need to continue to actually put wins on the board, which is something they have kind of struggled to do in recent years and almost cost them a tournament spot multiple times recently, and it did last year. And then finally, you have number 16 Kansas, who beat number 8 Iowa State, who has now lost 3 games in a row after a really, really dominant start to the season.
Okay, let's shift gears while staying in the world of basketball, but let's move on to the NBA, talk about some significant trades, and then also the standings in the NBA and the action of the last week.
Well, the standings might not get as much focus as they normally do. Normally, that is our main kind of look. This week is definitely all about the trades that were made. Honestly, thought I'd have a lot more to say about them, but at this point, I think everybody's kind of said what there is to say. So without further ado, start with the most recent trade, technically. Drew Eubanks and Patty Mills to the Clippers from Utah for Mo Bamba, PJ Tucker, a 2030 second round pick. And cash considerations, again, the Jazz have basically been involved in everything. They always are. Well, not they always are, but they always are now that Danny Ainge is there. He loves to stack up picks and just kind of take a swing and see who he might find in the draft. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But he's going to continue stacking up picks no matter what. Then you have the Lakers, who obviously completed the biggest deal of the week, acquiring Luka Doncic, Maxi Kleber, and Markieff Morris from the Mavs for Anthony Davis, Max Christie, a 2029 first round pick, and then also sending Jalen Hood-Schifino to the Jazz, speaking of the Jazz, and two 2025 second round picks. Still think the funniest thing about this trade was revealed yesterday when Danny Ainge said that he didn't know until 30 minutes before the trade was officially processed that the Lakers were getting Luka Doncic. He just knew that Utah was getting a call to be the third team in a trade and said, eh, you're giving me picks? Why not? I'll do it. I don't think he would have done that had he have known it was his mortal enemy, the Lakers. Of course, Danny Ainge with the heavy Celtics background. I don't think he would have done it, honestly. Could the Lakers have easily found another team to ship off Hood-Schifino and a few first round picks or for a few second round picks to, balance out the salary cap stuff? Yeah, absolutely. But of course, the story of this deal is just Luka Doncic for Anthony Davis. I think really the reason why I'm saying I don't really have much more to say about this is because everything has already been said. The Lakers got the better player, who's also the younger player, who's also less injury prone. The Mavs got the older player, who is a worse player. Oh, even though he's an all defensive player and an all NBA for and, an all NBA player as well. Luka is also both of those things and has finished higher in MVP voting and will continue to do so because he's 25 as opposed to AD, who's now in his early 30s. Is Max Christie a good piece? Sure, but in terms of winning now, I don't see how Max Christie helps you any more than Maxi Kleber and Markieff Morris would have, honestly. I guess he is probably a little bit better than, it's definitely better than Markieff Morris. And also a 2029 first round pick, that's not something that a team needs if they're in contention. So I just don't like it from the Mavs perspective, but I think, everybody's already said that. It's honestly one of the worst trades of all time because, as I said, normally, in a blockbuster deal like this, when you give up the bigger star in the deal, you're trying to get younger, or you are get yeah no you're trying to get younger or you're trying to get picks, as we saw with the Mikal Bridges trade, or in the in, you know the, he was worth like five first round picks from the Nets, or from the Knicks to the Nets. That is what you should be getting for a player like this. Luka should fetch a lot of a higher price. And as we know now, the Mavs didn't even check in with anybody else in the league. I mean, you look back at the Clippers deal with the Thunder to get Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and Paul George swapped it again. Paul George was the better player at the time, much older than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Now it looks like the Thunder have completely won that trade because the draft picks they got have turned into really great players. And Paul George, of course, not even on the Clippers anymore. But for the 5 years that they had him, he probably helped them win more with kind of their big three of, him, Kawhi, and James Harden for the limited time that all three of them were together, and at least the time that Paul George and Kawhi were together. He helped them win a lot more than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander probably would have in that time frame. But of course, the Thunder were trying to get younger and get better for the future. The future at this point is now. That was 6 years ago that trade happened, I think, maybe 5 years ago. But point being, the Thunder got a younger star for their aging star. That's what you're supposed to do. And at the time, Paul George was a better player than SGA. Is that true now? No. But that's not how, that is how you make trades in the NBA. You do not get the player who is younger and the player who's better at the same time. That's not supposed to happen. And that's what makes this deal so baffling from the Mavs perspective. But that is all I have to say about it. I think everybody agrees on that. One of the weirdest trades ever. Not a great trade for the Mavs whatsoever. Then you have the last deal of the week so far. The Spurs acquiring De'Aaron Fox and Jordan McLaughlin from the Kings. The Kings get Zach LaVine, Sidy Sissoko, a Charlotte first round pick for 2025, and it's lottery protected, which we know Charlotte is terrible. So that pick is not going to convey. And since it's not going to convey, it's going to become 2 second round picks, one in 2026 and one in 2027. They also got a 2025 second round pick from the Bulls, a 2027 first round pick from the Spurs, which looking at how good the Spurs are now, I don't think that's going to be that high of a pick, but it is going to be a first round pick. A 2028 second round pick from Denver, and they got their own 2028 second round pick back. And then, of course, the Bulls got Zach Collins, Trey Jones, Kevin Huerter, and their own first round pick back for this year. Does that mean they're tanking? Probably. But you know, you got to look at this trade. Honestly, the Bulls are lucky that the Lakers and Mavs made the deal that they did earlier in the week, because this is a really bad deal for the Bulls. I mean, the fact that the Kings got LaVine from the Bulls and got more picks than the Bulls did, you know, the Bulls again only added their own 2025 first round pick back that they had already traded away. The Kings had not that much leverage because they needed to trade away De'Aaron Fox because he already said he wasn't going to sign the extension, or maybe not, he already said, but that was the report. So if that's really the case, they couldn't do anything about it. They didn't have that much leverage. I'm shocked that they got all that they did out of it. I mean, Zach LaVine keeps them competitive for now. They have a really interesting front backcourt with Zach LaVine and Malik Monk. Obviously, De'Aaron Fox and Malik Monk was also really interesting. But you know, they can stay competitive for this year, kind of stay in that play-in race with Domantas Sabonis leading that team, and then also, like I said, LaVine and Monk kind of running things too. And then they also got picks so that they can get better in the future, kind of build, use some of those picks to build around Sabonis if things don't work out quite well in the near future. And then, of course, the Spurs, they're going to re-sign De'Aaron Fox, and we're going to have to deal with Stephon Castle, Devin Vassell, Wembanyama, De'Aaron Fox, Keldon Johnson, all those guys on the same team. I have no idea how the Spurs didn't have to give up any of their young stars. They didn't give up Sochan. They didn't give up Castle. They didn't give up Vassell. They didn't give up Keldon Johnson. It's really crazy how little the Spurs had to give up to get this deal done, but it's a really great deal for them. Fox and Wemby, I think, are going to be a really exciting duo, and I can't wait to see that team play in the future. A very young, promising team that's already kind of in the playoff picture. And speaking of the playoff picture, let's talk about the standings now. You have the Cavs in the East at 40-9. They're leading things. They've won four in a row. The Celtics, 35-15, are 5.5 back. They've won three in a row. The Knicks in third at 33-17, just two back of the Celtics. The Pacers at 28-20 are now in the fourth seed spot, thanks to Milwaukee's recent slump. The Pacers have won four in a row. The Bucks have lost four in a row. Now the Bucks are at 26-22, 13.5 back, and that means they're six back of the Knicks for the third seed. Of course, the Pacers, two games ahead of the Bucks and four games behind the Knicks. Then in the final playoff spot, that's not a play-in spot for now, are the Miami Heat, despite all the Jimmy Butler drama. They're 24-23. They are a half game ahead of the Pistons, who are at an even 25-25 in the seventh spot. The Magic, who are 1-9 in their last 10 and have lost four in a row, are now 24-27 on the season. They are 1.5 games back of the Pistons, two back of the Heat. They are still a half a game ahead of the Hawks, who have been on just as big of a slide. They're 2-8 in their last 10, at 23-27. Then, of course, you have the Bulls at 21-29, 3-7 in their last 10. The Sixers, who are 4-6 in their last 10 and somehow still in the playoff race at 19-29, just one game back of the Bulls with obviously a lot more talent than a lot of the teams that are right ahead of them. Then you have the Raptors and the Nets at 16-33 each. The Hornets, who are 12-35, they have lost five in a row. And the Wizards, who are 8-41 at the very bottom of the standings. In the West Coast, it's the Thunder who are at 39, or sorry, the Western Conference. I mean, yeah, it is the West Coast, kind of, but 39-9, the Thunder are. That's a half game back of the Cavs, of course, for the best record in the league. You have the Grizzlies who are playing really good right now. They're 34-16. They're 9-1 in their last 10. They're the 2 seed. The Rockets have lost 3 in a row to fall out of that 2 seed spot. They're 32-17, 1.5 back of the Grizzlies, 1.5 games ahead of the Nuggets, who are 31-19, 7-3 in their last 10. The Lakers sitting in the 5 seed at 28-19, 8-2 in their last 10 pre-Luka Doncic. We'll see if they continue to soar after they get him in that trade. Then you got the Clippers in the final non-play-in spot at 28-21. And then in the play-in spots, it is a really, really close bunch. You have the Timberwolves at 27-23. The Mavs, who are 1 game behind the Timberwolves at 26-24, the Kings, the Suns, and the Warriors, all at 25-24 in the 9, 10, and 11 spots. And then the Spurs, who, as we know, just got a lot better with De'Aaron Fox coming over there at 21-26, 3 games back of that giant bunch up. And now you've got to start talking about the Blazers, who are at 21-29. I know they haven't had a great start to the season, but they're 8-2 in their last 10, and they have the same amount of wins as the Spurs do, who are only 3 games back. So, yes, they're 5 back in the loss column of the Warriors, the Suns, and the Kings, but they're not that far off, and they're playing a lot better than a few of those teams ahead of them. So, kind of an interesting thing. You can't really count them out anymore. It's not really the bottom three just kind of being irrelevant in the West. There's now only the bottom two, which, of course, are the New Orleans Pelicans at 12-38. They've lost 6 in a row, and the Jazz at 11-37, who are 1-9 in their last 10.
All right. Well, that wraps this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be our 300th podcast. That will be next Tuesday, February 11th, where we will look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, review the Super Bowl, and we will talk again about basketball with another weekly review of both the most significant action in college basketball and doings in the NBA. In the meantime, please be sure to check out Patrick's additional content, including his weekly college basketball bracket updates, which will be posted weekly on Wednesdays throughout the season. And his picks for next weekend's games, which will be posted as always on Thursday. All that content on our social media handles at 4th and 24. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24 on Twitter and Instagram. And some of that content is still being posted to our website, 4thand24.com. Thank you for listening.